Good morning. Today I thought we would start with two gospel texts. The first one is from the 21st chapter of John, which is after the resurrection. And in the 15th verse, when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Tend my lambs." He said to him again a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Simon said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said to Peter, "Shepherd my sheep." He said to him a third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved by now because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Tend my sheep." Then from Mark 12, shortly before the crucifixion, I think this is in the temple, Jesus began to speak to them in parables. A man planted a vineyard and put a wall around it and dug a vat under the winepress and built a tower and rented it out to vine growers and went on a journey. At harvest time, he sent a slave to the vine growers in order to receive some of the produce of the vineyard from the vine growers. They took him and beat him and sent him away empty-handed. And again, he sent them another slave, and they wounded him in the head and treated him shamefully. And he sent another, and that one they killed. And so, with many others, beating some and killing others, he had one more to send, a beloved son. He sent him last of all to them, saying, "They will respect my son." But those vine growers said to one another, "This is the heir, let us kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." They took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. What will the owners of the vineyard do? They will come and destroy the vine growers and will give the vineyard to others. So that's the end of the scripture reading, and the children may leave if they wish. So it was just a year ago this week that we embarked on an overview of the Reformation, on the occasion of the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther's challenge to the sale of indulgences by the Church of Rome. I made 6 presentations on Luther and 3 on John Calvin, and of course this covered only the headlines and the slogans of the Reformation. That brief overview bypassed many significant figures and events in the Reformation, such as Zwingli, Erasmus, and the rise of various Anabaptist groups. The Anabaptists share several features with Quakers, and perhaps we can return to them at some future date. But today I feel some urgency to cross the English Channel to be in more familiar territory. Before we get to the origin of Quakers themselves, we need to understand the English context in which they arose, more than a century after the Reformation got underway. To understand this era, I have relied primarily on a book written about 50 years ago by Christopher Hill, a historian at Oxford University. That book takes a sociological approach to the English Reformation and the preceding century under the Tudor dynasty, which ended in 1603 with the death of Elizabeth. The situation in England was quite different from that of Germany, France, and Switzerland, where the Reformation first took root. Conditions in the British Isles were, if possible, even more brutal than those on the European continent. The English Reformation began about 10 years after the Lutheran Reformation, and it starts with King Henry VIII, who began to break away from the Church of Rome in 1527 when the Pope refused to grant Henry an annulment of his marriage to Catherine of Aragon, the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain. Henry desperately wanted a male heir, and Catherine had produced only one daughter named Mary, who survived childhood. This was not only a matter of the king's ego, large though that was, for it was widely acknowledged that England could be engulfed in a civil war if there was no son to succeed Henry. Therefore, Henry's break with Rome received widespread support from the English Parliament, and Henry punished any dissenters to this break without mercy. If Henry could imprison his wife Catherine and execute several wives, he would not hesitate to eliminate anyone he wished. The tawdry and appalling saga of Henry's quest for a male heir fills many tabloid biographies, and there was indeed a lot of material to work with there. But what is less widely appreciated about Henry's reformation is that he took control of monastic properties in the course of breaking with the Church of Rome. Monasteries owned enormous estates in England, where they functioned somewhat like a social safety net, crude though it must have been. Henry dispossessed these monastic lands, and he disbanded the monks and the nuns. He later sold those lands, primarily to finance a war with France. The people who purchased those monastic estates from Henry were wealthy individuals whom Henry favored. The sale was intended both to raise funds for the war and to cement loyalty to Henry. The net result was the privatization of church property. After this land passed into private hands, these landowners were very nervous that Henry or any future ruler might restore a connection to the Church of Rome, which could demand the return of these former monastic estates. This produced in the ruling class of England a nearly hysterical fear of Catholicism that persisted for centuries, even down to the present era. Henry's daughter Mary did, during her short reign, restore England to the orbit of Rome, but she met strong opposition from the owners of large estates, and her early death brought an end to her endeavor. Anti-Catholic feelings persisted and flared up repeatedly over the subsequent centuries in England. This partially reflects English nationalism and partly theological objections, but economic considerations also played a major role. Here is a much abbreviated list from William Tyndale, the early translator of the Bible, whose work is, a great deal of his work is present in the King James Version. So this is a list concerning various fees imposed by the Church of Rome before the Reformation. Tithes. Mortuaries, bans, weddings, offerings at weddings, offerings at funerals, offerings to images, offerings of wax, and the waste of wax, and the torches and tapers throughout the land, then brotherhoods and pardoners, and lastly, what swarms of begging friars there are. The parson sheareth, the vicar shaveth, the priest poleth, the friar scrapeth, and the pardoner pareth. We lack but a butcher to pull off the skin. If a tenth part of this tyranny were given to the king, what would it grow to? Other economic developments also began to affect England in the 16th century. Spain stole shiploads of gold and silver from Mexico and Peru over the course of the 16th century. This fueled a steep demand for luxury goods in Spain, including fine woolen cloth. England had a good climate for raising sheep, and the demand for wool clothing stimulated a boom in sheep production across England. Large private estates shifted away from a loose system of subsistence farming that supported a large rural population of peasants and replaced farming with the cultivation of sheep. It is relevant to note here that George Fox spent some time in his youth herding sheep. Peasants were driven from their ancestral lands, which they cultivated but they did not own, in a process called the enclosures. Lands which had been cultivated in common were enclosed for raising sheep, and peasants were forced to live in towns and cities under crowded and unsanitary conditions. The urban poor would provide the basis for the Industrial Revolution a century later in an ongoing legacy of oppression and neglect. It should be noted that this displacement of a rural population also took place during the Roman invasion of Palestine during the first century BCE. Jewish peasants who initially did own land were dispossessed through taxation and predatory lending by the Romans in order to create large estates owned by Roman landlords in Italy, primarily for the cultivation of grapes to produce wine or export to Rome. Remember, that was the context of the parable that we just read. This is the situation that Jesus encountered as a young man in the second and third decades of the first century. Peasants lost their land and were forced to live in squalor in towns and cities. The town of Capernaum on the Sea of Galilee, where Peter was a fisherman, had a processing plant for fish sauce, which was exported to Rome. Fish that were too small to sell were fermented to make a heady condiment favored by the Romans. Urban desperation in Palestine escalated into civil war and a rebellion against Rome in the seventh decade, and a full invasion by Roman legions with the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. A second rebellion takes place in 110 AD, and a third and final rebellion in 132 AD. Afterwards, Jews become pacifists for the next 1800 years until the founding of Israel in 1948. This is very nearly the same timescale that takes place in England, where the English Revolution occurs about a century after the English Reformation, which had produced extensive displacement of rural peasant populations. In England, the landowners took Jesus literally and began to raise sheep rather than people. They could sell wool to Spain for more money than they could make by collecting rents from peasants who had lived on monastic estates for centuries. In England, the Reformation disrupted social patterns and bonds between lords and peasants, which had existed for centuries. Under feudalism, both lords and peasants swore allegiance to one another. Loyal subjects were the real wealth of nations under feudalism, and intelligent landowners recognized their dependence on peasants to maintain their estates and to grow food. When Mexican silver and Peruvian gold flooded Europe in the 16th century, it disrupted those bonds, pushed peasants off the land, and promoted the production of wool for export. This is, among other things, an illustration of taking the Bible too literally. Did Jesus really tell Peter to feed sheep? The next time someone says that the Bible is literally true, ask them how many sheep they own. In any event, sheep flourished during the English Reformation, but peasants had a hard time. So did landowners. The influx of silver and gold produced inflation and economic instability and indebtedness at all levels of the British economy. And this instability forced landowners to increase rents, which further impoverished the rural population. And in the landowning class, these changes favored thriftiness and industry, while profligate habits of royalty disappeared and became unaffordable. Today, we can see a similar process at work under yet another dispensation of globalization. American corn production is subsidized and sold without tariffs to Mexico and Central American countries, where it underprices local corn production, leaving local farmers in debt and ruin. These farmers move to crowded cities, and the cultivation of the land is taken over by corporations to grow food for export, while drugs, gang violence, and assassination grow commonplace in those cities, leading some people to seek safety in the United States as refugees. When we look at the parable of the wicked tenants, we should place that parable in the context of peasant life in the third decade of the first century, during the ministry of Jesus. We should also see a parable as a device for drawing people into conversation with one another, rather than a coded message for transmitting timeless truths. Jesus told parables not so much to teach people, but to organize people. The organization that he started still survives today as the church. Remember also that the last shall be first and the first shall be last. This parable, as we receive it in the written gospels today, appears to vindicate the landlord, who was living abroad and made reasonable demands on his tenants. He wanted some of the grape harvest. However, when Jesus told this parable in the back alleys of Capernaum to people who had been dispossessed of their ancestral lands by Roman moneylenders, tax collectors, and landlords, and dishonest judges, the landlord's demands might not seem so reasonable. The tenants, or the dispossessed tenants, might ask, whose land was it, after all, that this foreign landlord now controls? They might say with some justice, it's our land. Let's reclaim it. Si se puede. So we should read the Bible with historical insight, and we should read history with biblical insight. Ask yourselves how the stories that began in the back alleys of Capernaum, reeking with fermenting fish and teeming with people driven from their land in great poverty, are later refashioned in the written Gospels to make them palatable across the Roman Empire after the fall of Jerusalem in the 8th decade. How does that new setting alter the message that appears on the printed page? And remember that the original purpose of parables was to organize the dispossessed. I regret that I will need to leave early today, so I won't be able to engage you as closely as I would like to, but during this coming period of quiet, we might begin some thoughts or conversations about how this parable applies to the 21st century.